takes on his indictment.
No, this is rule of law. This is not about politics. He's committed crimes. He's committed many crimes. This is one of them.
They're only trying to stay in power. That's all it's all about. It's not about the people. It's about power.
The former president pleaded not guilty to all the charges before flying to Florida to address his supporters.
This fake case was brought only to interfere with the upcoming 2024 election, and it should be dropped immediately. Immediately.
Trump, who faces a maximum prison sentence of 136 years, also repeated claims that widespread fraud had robbed him of re-election in 2020 when he lost to Democrat Joe Biden. He ended his speech by warning that the United States has now turned into a mess.
Incredibly, we are now a failing nation. We are a nation in decline. And now these radical left lunatics want to interfere with our elections by using law enforcement.
The judge has set the next hearing for the 4th of December. An indictment or conviction will not legally prevent Trump from running for president in 2024. While the facts are dramatic and the indictment explosive, the case could hinge on an untested legal theory. Although a conviction is far from assured, what is clear is that it would deepen the political divide in a country where national security is at or near an all-time low.
The situation of children in Afghanistan is alarming, according to a recent report by the United Nations Children's Fund. UNICEF says it has recently screened over 1 million children under 5 years of age for acute malnutrition. The UN body notes that nearly 900,000 children are suffering from severe malnourishment, a life-threatening condition that requires immediate treatment. Experts say the ongoing food insecurity and poverty, among other factors, are pushing Afghan children and women into malnutrition and starvation.
Malnutrition is caused by a deficiency of energy and protein, which are supposed to be provided by food. Complete food comes from a good economy. Unfortunately, many Afghan families can't provide enough food for their children. As a result, they face malnutrition. Natural disasters and an inappropriate environment also contribute to malnourishment. Afghan children are facing all these factors, and they're very much exposed to malnutrition and its starvation.
We're living on borrowed money and food from our neighbors. When they run out, we have nothing to feed our children. My disabled husband used to have a job, but now he is unemployed. I have no money to buy medicine or food for my children and myself. Therefore, they're always suffering from malnutrition.
UNICEF also says that more than 15 million children in Afghanistan are in need of humanitarian assistance. The UN agency has appealed for more funding and support to help 19 million people in Afghanistan, including children and women. This call is echoed by the Afghan Health Ministry, which is also complaining about the harsh effects of the U.S. sanctions and freezing of Afghan assets.
Health services have nothing to do with politics. The U.S. and its allies freezing of our assets and sanctioning our country is an illogical move. Our assets are the rights of all Afghans, so they must be able to enjoy them. If such sanctions and restrictions continue, the health sector will be crushed further. Therefore, we are calling for the removal of sanctions and more health assistance, so we can make hospitals and health centers operational.
Besides malnutrition, another challenge faced by Afghan children is the lack of access to basic services, such as water, sanitation, and health care. The UNICEF report adds, Afghan hospitals are also under stress in the face of growing diseases and major cuts in funding. Afghan children are facing increasing miseries amid economic and food crisis in their country. Advocates are appealing to the international community to step up its solidarity with and generosity towards Afghan children. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
As International Quds Day approaches, large billboards with the theme of Iftar in Quds have been going up across the capital, Kabul. The goal is to support occupied Al-Quds and the Palestinian nation. People of Afghanistan consider Al-Quds as a source of religious unity and brotherhood against hegemonic powers or the global arrogance.
Quds.
Al-Quds is in the hearts of all Muslims, as it's the first Qibla in Islam. Palestine and Al-Quds are a factor for awakening and uniting Muslims. All Muslims should know that the global arrogance is behind the issue of Palestine, that makes Al-Quds a symbol of the fight against arrogant powers and bullies for Muslim nations worldwide.
Supporting the Palestinian nation is an issue that the people of Afghanistan have always insisted on. The people here hope that in the not-too-distant future, the Palestinian nation and the Holy Quds will be freed from the occupation of the Zionist regime.
I personally wish that I visit that area one day, but I hope that they come soon and that they Palestine and Jerusalem and every other area in that geography that once belonged to the Palestine, the state of Palestine and its people should be free.
The Israeli regime has in recent months stepped up its atrocities, killing around 100 Palestinians this year alone.
The people of Afghanistan are against the Israeli occupation of Palestine. This is also as they have endured tyranny and are familiar with the crimes committed during the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan for over two decades. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
In a shocking first, the United States has arrested and indicted their front-running presidential candidate and a former president, Donald Trump. Trump is charged with falsifying legal records related to legal hush money he paid in a salacious alleged affair. Polls show that 60% of Americans think the arrest was politically motivated, but many don't seem to mind, as 60% of Americans also say they approve of the indictment.
I agree. I don't think anybody should be above the law, and that's not from a, you know, oh, I'm glad he's going to be indicted. If it were a Democrat or Libertarian, Green Party, I don't care what stripe they have. If they break the law should apply to all of us.
It's considered the weakest of the handful of pending cases resulting from Trump's time in office, and it pales in comparison to other apparent crimes. Iran has issued a warrant for Trump's arrest on murder and terrorism charges related to the killing of Iranian anti-terror hero General Qasem Soleimani. Domestically, other recent U.S. presidents have escaped indictments even when they involve the death and suffering of millions of people, such as George W. Bush and Harry Truman. Richard Nixon got a presidential pardon for crimes committed against the United States. Bill Clinton destroyed Yugoslavia, and his wife Hillary gloated over doing the same for Libya. None of these leaders have ever faced a trial, but some hope that the prosecution of Trump will start a new era.
I do support it. And I hope that, you know, going forward that, you know, this is a testament to our, you know, our justice system, and that I think it shows that we are willing to, you know, go against the rich, even though, you know, he's rich and powerful. You know, our Supreme Court is willing to do what is necessary to put these people and hold them accountable. So I hope that we can continue to do this forward, going forward with other people, other political figures, and hold people accountable overall.
Charges of election interference and political persecution are now certain to dangerously divide the country. Trump can still run for the presidency even if convicted, and most analysts say a conviction appears unlikely. However, Democrats appear to be betting that the disgrace of being the first indicted president ever will be enough to tip the scales in what will likely be a tightly contested vote in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
caskets draped in Iranian flags and carried in a mass procession. People from all walks of life following the trucks carrying the coffins of Milad Haydari and Mehrdad Mehrani, making their way to Tehran's Shuhada Square from Imam Hussein Square, where the funeral ceremony began just a few hours earlier.
All of those who have attended the funeral are here to renew their allegiance to the values that these martyrs sacrificed their lives to uphold.
We are here to show that we will continue backing the Islamic Republic. The huge crowds that you see here have gathered today to thank our martyrs for the sacrifices they made.
The Iranian IRGC military advisors were martyred in Friday's aerial assaults conducted by Israel on the suburbs of Damascus. Haydari, a 32-year-old father of two, was from Kurdistan province, and Mehrani, 31, who later succumbed to his wounds, had a 2-year-old son.
I personally came here because my brother was murdered, and I strongly believe in the choice that they made. This murder will never be forgotten.
Attending this ceremony is the least we could do to send a strong message to the world, particularly to our enemies. It's also a token of our gratitude for what the martyrs have done and the sacrifices they've made.
We will support the Islamic Revolution to the last drop of our blood. We will support our leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and no matter what happens, we will always support our martyrs.
Men and women in black followed them, weeping for the martyrs that sacrificed their lives in the fight against terrorism in the region. But most importantly, they are here to once again pledge allegiance to the values these martyrs died for.
Huge masses gathered downtown Tehran in Imam Hussein Square to bid farewell to the two martyrs and also to tell the world that they will continue to walk down their path. Ahmadi, Tehran.
A selection of rare manuscripts of the Holy Quran, which have been calligraphed and illuminated centuries ago, has been put on display in an exhibition in Pakistan. The week-long exhibition, organized by the cultural section of Iran's embassy in Islamabad, showcases dozens of rare manuscripts of the Holy Quran, written by prominent Iranian and Pakistani artists. Over 40 historical Quran manuscripts kept by the Iran-Pakistan Persian Language Studies Center have been put on display at the event.
Islam's holy book, the Holy Quran, was revealed in its entirety to Prophet Muhammad some 40 centuries ago during the fasting month of Ramadan. That is why this exhibition takes place during the holy month.
The organizers of the exhibition emphasize the youth of today should be made aware of Quran's significant importance.
The key purpose of this exhibition is to get people more familiar with Quran. Muslims need each other's help to solve their current issues, and Quran is the ideal tool for doing so because it is the pillar of Muslim solidarity.
Participants in the opening ceremony say the exhibition can be appealing to the students and artists and also help develop cultural cooperation between Iran and Pakistan.
The manuscripts of Quran displayed here show the depth of attention and familiarity of our past with the Holy Quran. One of the goals of this exhibition is to promote the teachings of our divine book, especially among the younger generation.
The exhibition, which will run till April 7th, is expected to attract a large number of visitors as it provides an opportunity for Muslims to learn about the latest studies on the impact of Quranic teachings on everyday life. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Large field kitchen has become a usual scene in Ramadan every year since the war started in Syria. An NGO named Saad has been cooking warm meals for the needy in the fasting month for over a decade now. This year, they have expanded their massive kitchens in four Syrian cities, making over 20,000 meals for free.
This is our 11th year. This year is different from all previous ones as we faced earthquakes in Aleppo. Our kitchens were established directly at that time, even before Ramadan. People's needs are doubling this year. People depend on us now every year. About 20,000 meals are produced daily.
The organization depends on donations, both cash and food supplements. Volunteers arrive early in the day to prepare, plan, and cook a specific meal to be distributed before sunset. Zahra says every capable Syrian should shoulder some responsibility to help others during this crisis.
I feel related to this initiative in Ramadan every year. I can't imagine myself not helping during this month. It feels incredibly good to know I'm helping in feeding thousands of people. It's a responsibility and an expression of love to my people.
We start working every day at 9 a.m. We prepare the ingredients of the meal, such as meat, rice, and vegetables. We produce the meals, wrap them, and distribute them to the needy, mainly in poor areas and earthquake-affected parts of Syria.
The recent earthquakes exacerbated the already tough economic conditions in Syria. The UN says 70% of the population needs humanitarian assistance, while 6.8 million people have been internally displaced.
Syrians have endured almost all factors that could bring a person to the brink of poverty, from foreign-backed war and terrorism to U.S. and Western economic sanctions and the recent devastating earthquakes. In this unprecedented scenario, such initiatives are sometimes life-saving for the poor and constitute a message of unity among Syrians. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Top NGOs gathered in the United States for a peace summit with the stated goal of fighting the war machine. The forum sought to empower and organize activists to stop U.S.-backed wars in Palestine, Yemen, Ukraine, and elsewhere, but they know that cultural resistance to peace appears deep.
We in the U.S. are so ingrained that domination of the world is our right. And, you know, being a nation founded on genocide, founded on slavery and those types of things, domination is just kind of in the air. And it seems normal, but it's really not normal.
Last month marked the 20th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. The war is widely considered a disaster, even within the United States, and yet Washington's foreign policy remains just as belligerent.
In 2002, polls showed that 67% of Americans disapproved of taking military action against Iraq. But then-Senator Joe Biden led the Democratic Party's bipartisan effort to invade. As president, Biden has stifled peace efforts, sent massive amounts of arms, and created a new quagmire, this time in Ukraine.
Well, we don't really have democracy. We have a state that calls itself a democracy. Biden just had a democracy summit, but we have a rigged system. We're allowed to vote, but that process is in itself corrupt. It gives the impression that we have input when we do not. The people don't have representation in this country. Defense contractors do, real estate developers do, big pharma does, but the people do not.
However, we're a long way from 2002. Many speakers noted the newfound inability of Washington to act unilaterally, which many around the world view as a positive.
And now you have other countries around the world. You have China, Russia, Iran, India. We have these emerging countries that represent regional threats, only because these countries now have the ability to chart their own paths of independent development. And that is very concerning to the United States and its goals of, you know, world hegemony.
The United States has existed for 246 years and been at war for 228 of them. They have nearly 800 military bases stationed in over 40% of the world's nations. Washington's war machine is strong, but activists say the average American's desire for peace is far stronger. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now Saudi Arabia is inviting Syria to rejoin the Arab League and to attend the next meeting, which will be held in Saudi Arabia itself. What does it all mean and why now? Stay with us on this Spotlight to find out. I'd like to welcome my guest now to the program. Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, out of Manchester.
and Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist out of St. Petersburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, thank you both for being with me on this spotlight. Let's start it off in Manchester. And Peter, your evaluation of the role Russia is playing to try to mend fences between Damascus and Riyadh. Let's start from there.
Yeah, Russia has played an extremely important role as a kind of marriage broker, an intermediary at what used to be a difficult moment in Saudi-Syrian relations, given that Saudi Arabia had been supporting the armed opposition. This is what Russia does so well, serious diplomacy. In fact, they're giving the Americans a master class in how to conduct Middle East diplomacy. And this summit with Assad, probably invited, is going to crown their achievements.
Isha, why do you think this rapprochement is taking place at this time by these Arab countries?
Well, obviously, one of the biggest signs is the declining U.S. influence in the region, because back in 2013, when all these countries broke off ties, they were very confident that the opposition side would win this war. And on top of that, they also did not want to isolate or alienate the U.S. By disobeying them. And so what this shows is obviously the fact that the Syrian Arab Army has been very successful in the past 8 to 9 years in pushing the opposition's territorial gains to a very small area. And number two is, of course, the West's waning influence in the Middle East. Just a month ago, there was China brokered a deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And as Iran and Syria have been allies for a really long time, it's a natural progression that Syria will be welcomed back into the fold.
Hmm. Well, Peter, in general, what does it mean for Syria? When it was constantly told, I mean, from 2013 on, how many times we heard Assad must go, that government must be overthrown. And now, years later, the Syrian government is intact. So many of those Western governments that said that, the heads have been changed. And what does it mean now for the Syrians when these Arab countries are coming back and trying to reestablish diplomatic ties?
It's kind of symbolically important more than militarily important. It's been a long time now that the Arab, or most of the Gulf countries, stopped giving active support to the armed opposition in Syria. So it's not this new rapprochement is not going to change what was already an improved situation on the ground, but it's very important politically. It demonstrates that Syria has survived, that Syria is going from strength to strength regionally, and I think above all, it puts pressure on the United States, which is going to interpret this as a slap in the face, and indeed that is what it is. Let us not make any mistake, this is a big step back for U.S. Regional diplomacy, and a calculated one on the part of Saudi Arabia. a lesson to the Americans and will put them under pressure to withdraw their forces from Syria, which is the biggest obstacle to Syria's recovery, because the Americans control the area that has Syria's oil and grain.
Okay, we're going to get on to that again a little bit later. But in general, Isha, I want to look at, Peter talked about this being a slap in the face to the Americans. I want to look at that, expand on that a little bit more, because now with Saudi Arabia actually reestablishing or trying to reestablish ties and inviting Syria to rejoin the Arab League, what is the difference now as opposed to years ago? Saudi Arabia would not have dared to go against its Washington masters, but tell me your take on what is going on.
About a year ago, China and Saudi Arabia had a long discussion and kind of got into an agreement where there was some military security issues. And so, of course, this means that Saudi Arabia feels less threatened, more confident in opposing the U.S. On top of it, the opposition has failed, so they don't have to worry about the wrath of the opposition, who naturally are members of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc., coming back home and feeling that wrath. So I think those are the two things. On top of this, I read a Council for Foreign Relations report where President Biden last year basically wanted MBS to increase the oil production to bring down the oil. And they literally said that Saudi Arabia's traditional role is to basically pump when we ask them and to not pump when we ask them. And I think for Saudi Arabia, they realized that just being the pumper of oil for Washington is not a long-term viable strategy. So I think these things combined, and also just looking at the weakening of the U.S. influence in this region, has made them think about their priorities and think about their longer term survival. And that's why this is going on, in my opinion.
Well, Peter, your take, how do you think this is going to affect Riyadh-Washington relations now that Riyadh is making these type of moves that they are?
Well, I think turn in Saudi strategy occurred really about 3 years ago, at the time of there was a tanker war going on in the Gulf, and it was all part of the American economic war on Iran, and America's stepped up effort at that time to stop Iranian tankers taking oil through the Gulf. And about that time, there was an attack on a Saudi oil refinery by a drone attack. Many observers attributed that to Iran, but it wasn't clear. Anyway, Saudi Arabia, I believe, drew the conclusion at that moment that it could not rely on American protection. And what was striking was that when it happened, the U.S. Ships that were in the area withdrew so that they would be out of range of drone attack. That, I think, underlined to the Saudis that they were on their own and that they were more likely to be dragged into America's wars than have America defend Saudi Arabia. And what we've seen over the last 3 years has been the gradual elaboration of this tendency. Saudi realism, they realize that they have to get along with Iran. We saw the recent meeting of the two, and now this new step goes further to cement the new relationship.
Well, Isha, Russia also wants to help Syria and Turkey reestablish relations. Let's talk about that side of things. How likely do you see this happening? And especially that, you know, Turkey is still occupying Syrian territory. Your assessment of that?
Well, there's two things. Yes, Turkey is still occupying Syrian territory, and they're also funding a lot of the opposition in that territory, too. So I think for Syria for there to be a realistic rapprochement, Turkey definitely needs to pull back from the occupied territory. And worst of all, in the territories that have Turkey-friendly troops occupying it, basically that's where one-third of Syria's grain grows and a large portion of Syria's oil. And basically Syria is not getting the hard currency from that area. And that is a big problem for Syria. And Washington's strategy about in 2019, the Deputy Defense Secretary basically mentioned the strategy of how they wanted to occupy this area as a way of like starving Syria out so that people would not want the Syrian Arab army and the current government there. And so as long as Turkey is aiding and abetting that, it's going to be hard. But I also think that Turkey understands what's going on because a few months ago there was a terrorist attack in Turkey and the Turkish foreign minister refused to accept Washington's condolences because obviously it seems like they have intelligence as to who is really behind it. So I think there are two things. Turkey understands its precarious position and the fact that Russia is a neighbor and there's the big Black Sea area that and it's like geostrategic position there. So, but on the other hand, Turkey is definitely occupying, was a large player in this war. So I feel like, again, Turkey is probably thinking about the long-term interests and what suits their business interests and what suits their military interests. Mm-hmm. And so I think they're more open to negotiation now than they ever were before.
Okay. Peter, I want to pose that same question. I want to hear your take on the Turkey-Syria aspect of it. And also, can Syria really return to normal when they have such vast amounts of land still being occupied, when the United States, American troops are there, when the Americans are stealing their oil? I'd like to hear your perspective on both.
Erdogan is under a lot of domestic pressure to fix the Syrian file. Turkey has been hosting over 1 million Syrian refugees, and most Turks want them returned to Syria. That's not going to happen while Turkey has bad relations with Syria and is effectively occupying part of Syria. It was always inevitable that sooner or later Turkey would withdraw from northwest Syria. They're not defending any Turkish-speaking minority. They have no claims on territory in Syria. Their efforts to change the government in Syria are obviously not going to succeed. So it was inevitable that sooner or later they were going to draw the conclusion that they should withdraw. But the problem is how to withdraw gracefully. And this, I think, is where Russian diplomacy is key. They've advanced very, very gradually, quietly, a lot of work behind the scenes. But it does look now, with this quadripartite meeting on the horizon, that the end is in sight. And at some point in the next 12 months, the Turkish forces will withdraw, probably leaving a situation, a rather messy situation, similar to that you have in southern Syria, where, again, Russia brokered a peace that left some of the armed militias still keeping some of their weapons, but effectively working with the government. It's going to be very messy, especially in Idlib. There are going to be a lot of security problems. Mm-hmm. Syria will be keen to reestablish its sovereignty over the northwest, and then again that will put pressure on the Americans to remove their last piece on the chessboard in Syria and allow Syria to get back control of its oil. And this question is absolutely key to Syria's economic and therefore political recovery. The top priority is to get back control of those oil and grain-rich provinces. Mm-hmm. But Syria is used to suffering misery. They have immense resilience.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, well, Isha, what about the Israeli role in all of this in trying to create chaos in Syria? I mean, we've just witnessed a few more attacks on Syrian soil. Tell me about that side of things.
Well, there are two things. Of course, Israel sees Iran and also Hezbollah, which as a big existential threat. And they identify, unfortunately, Syria as, they think Syria is a client state of Iran. And so, unfortunately, they see this as a security threat. That's the first thing. The second thing is that the amount of action that the U.S. can actually take in Syria is limited. As we learned last week, there was a drone strike that actually did hit a U.S. airbase. So Israel is basically acting as U.S.'s long arm in the region in order to continue the U.S. interests. And the U.S. strategy is definitely based on the continued presence of the moderate rebels and also the ability for the occupied territories to take away Syria's oil and Syria's grain and other things. So Israel has been doing that. And of course, there's the issue of Golan Heights, which Israel took from Syria. And recently, Syria asserted that it wanted it back. So I think these three issues have kind of culminated in the most recent attack on Homs.
Well, Peter, is all of this what we're seeing just indicative of the end of the U.S. rules-based international order?
Permit me a hollow laugh about that phrase, rules-based. The rules that they make, mm-hmm. but not internationally approved rules, not the UN Charter, not the ICC, the International Criminal Court, to which America is not a party, although they try to make use of it against Russia. I think the rest of the world it just laughs when America and Europe uses this phrase, respect for the rules-based order. That means their order,
right.
Them ordering the rest of the world around. But if I may, just to go back to these Israeli attacks, which are, of course, blatant contraventions of international law, and any kind of rules-based order, I think we can interpret them as a sign of failure. The Israelis say they're carrying out these attacks to stop Iran becoming more entrenched in Syria. Well, if they're having to increase so much the number of these attacks, there have been 9 so far this year, I believe, doesn't that prove that the strategy is failing and that Iran is, if anything, ever more deeply entrenched in Syria? And why? Precisely to help Syria defend itself against Israel.
Isha, your overall perspective, the future of Syria, what do you think it will take to get Syria up and running again, a more sense of normalcy again?
The very first thing is weakening the sanctions regime. The sanctions that the U.S. put Syria under is completely draconian. And the problem is that even when something is not covered under sanctions, companies are afraid of getting the wrath of the U.S. and European community that they just won't sell. So Syria has trouble getting medical equipment. Syria has trouble getting ambulances. These basic things, they have trouble with construction and equipment. So definitely weakening and eliminating or finding a workaround the U.S. sanctions, which are extensive. And even after the recent earthquake, the U.S. refused to change it or lower it, even though they claimed they did. They didn't actually end up doing it. So that is the first thing. The second thing is, of course, getting rid of the area in the northeast that's been occupied by Rojava and also other moderate rebels, because that is such a resource-rich area for Syria, and they need all the hard currency they can get in order to trade and get new equipment for reconstruction. Those are the main two things. And of course, having diplomatic relations restored with other with other Arab countries is going to help the trade part. And it's going to be a long road, and it's a very difficult road as long as the U.S. and U.K. and NATO keep their current position on Syria.
Okay. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria out of Manchester. Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist out of St. Petersburg. We appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In Britain, low-income households will spend on average £200 more on bills than last year, the consumer body Which? Has warned. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered the story and tells us more. Some of the United Kingdom's least well-off households could be left more than £200 worse off on their energy bills this year because of reduced government support, the consumer body Which? Has warned. Joining calls made by other campaigners, it said the government urgently needed to introduce a social tariff for gas and electricity to protect the most financially vulnerable. Consumers have been spared an increase to their energy costs equivalent to £500 on the typical annual bill originally planned to come in from 1st of April until a government U-turn. However, a separate scheme that provided all households with a £400 discount, giving them £66 or £67 off their energy bills every month from October of 2022 through to March of 2023 inclusive, has just come to an end. Which said that even with the government's decision to keep the energy price guarantee at £2,500 for an average household until July rather than putting it up to £3,000, millions of low-income consumers would still face higher energy bills this financial year. While analysts have predicted that annual energy bills could typically fall to about £2,000 from this summer, consumers will still be paying almost double what they were paying before the energy crisis began. Which predicted that these factors combined will mean the poorest 10% of households in Britain will have to spend an average of £209 more on energy this financial year compared to last year. It said the average low-income consumer used less energy than those on higher incomes, so they would not benefit as much from the anticipated falls in energy prices, but would still feel the full loss of the £400 of additional government support. Higher costs could be particularly difficult to manage for prepayment meter users, many of whom are on low incomes, because, unlike direct debit customers, they cannot spread their costs across the whole year and so would see a spike in costs during the cold winter months, which said ministers had announced the cost of living payments to those on qualifying benefits would continue, but added this will leave low-income households who are struggling to make ends meet but do not qualify for benefits out in the cold. A properly targeted social tariff, a discounted energy rate for those most in need, was desperately needed, it added. Calls for a social tariff have been growing louder, with Citizens Advice and the consumer champion Martin Lewis among those increasing pressure on the British government over the issue. A recent study suggested such a tariff could save 12 million households on the lowest income, an average of £381 a year, and up to £1,500 in some cases. The government has announced a package of cost-of-living support, including a £900 cash boost for more than 8 million eligible means-tested benefits claimants, including people on universal credit, pension credit, and tax credits, to be paid into bank accounts in 3 instalments between this spring and spring of 2024. Site irishnews.com has also covered this story and tells us more. Consumer groups have called for an energy social tariff in the form of cash payments for the poorest households ahead of what they warn could be a decade of high bills. Citizens Advice said payments of up to £1,500 are now an essential long-term solution for millions of fuel-poor households, both now and during what could be a decade of record prices. The call for targeted financial support by next year has the backing of a coalition of consumer and energy bodies, including Martin Lewis and Energy UK, and is part of a new report commissioned by Citizens Advice, following 9 months of consultation with industry and the public. The report recommends cash payments according to individual household need, delivered through a combination of HMRC data on household incomes and energy supplier knowledge of how much electricity and gas is used to show a picture of who needs help and by how much. More than 12 million British households on the lowest income would qualify for support, and the average qualifying household would see their energy bill reduced by £381, with some getting up to £1,500, according to the report's analysis. Currently, households are spending more than twice as much on energy compared with 18 months ago, regardless of whether the government's energy price guarantee remains at £2,500, as is widely expected, rather than rises to the previously announced £3,000 from April. If the energy price guarantee remains at £2,500, 10 million households will face crisis-level energy costs, with more than 10% of their income after housing costs going to energy, a key indicator of fuel poverty, the charity said. If the energy price guarantee increases to £3,000, that figure rises to 12 million households, it warned. People on the lowest income will be hit much harder, with energy make up more than half of their total household income after housing costs in either scenario, up from 34% in 2019. Citizens Advice said it helped 50% more people with energy issues last year than the year before, and more than double that of 2020. Last year, it saw more people who could not afford to top up their prepayment meter than in the previous 10 years combined. The charity warned energy prices are not expected to return to pre-pandemic levels for the next decade. The report also calls for a national programme of loft and cavity wall insulation for all households in fuel poverty. Citizens Advice Chief Executive Dame Claire Moriarty said Energy affordability is a long-term problem that needs a long-term solution. A social tariff protects millions of people from spending excessive amounts on their energy bills. High energy costs have left too many people choosing between heating and eating. Uncertainty over future high prices only adds to the stress and worry felt in households across the country. This policy helps make energy bills more affordable in the years ahead and supports the shift to warmer, safer homes that are ready for the net zero transition.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.